This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Pol Pot's death last week raises the question if he was never held accountable for the killing of nearly 2 million Cambodians, who can be, and will they ever be prosecuted? That question is now being debated in the United Nations and in Cambodia itself. After decades of inaction, the U.S. last year called for accountability of the Khmer Rouge and spearheaded the effort to capture Pol Pot. For nearly 20 years, Ben Kiernan has been gathering evidence of Khmer Rouge war crimes, which he hopes could be used to convict the remaining leaders. Kiernan heads the Cambodian Genocide Program at Yale University. They also have a counterpart in Phnom Penh called the Documentation Center of Cambodia. Together, they've acquired a vast amount of information about exactly what happened in Cambodia between 1975 and 1979, when the Khmer Rouge was in power.
There are various caches of documents that we've uncovered at various stages. The most recent and the largest cache is the security archives of the Khmer Rouge secret police, in which reports of repression and arrests around the country are forwarded to the top leaders of the regime, particularly those responsible for security, and copied to others, which shows the involvement of all the top leaders of the regime, including some of those still alive, in the actual repression and knowledge of the repression and involvement in the repression. We also have a large number of documents recording the minutes of meetings of the top ruling body, that is the Standing Committee of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Kampuchea, in which the top central leaders of the Pol Pot regime got together and made decisions and made statements and held meetings, which are recorded pretty much verbatim, along with a list of those present and what they said.
How did you get these documents?
That particular group of documents I have had in my collection for 12 or 13 years. More recently, the security police archives came to light, and we are currently cataloging and researching that material, which is a much larger collection.
How did they come to light?
We have Cambodian colleagues in the field who are very effective and very determined to document exactly what happened and to search everywhere for all possible sources of evidence. And they knocked on doors and kept knocking on doors until documents were produced, and we were able to build up the largest collection of Khmer Rouge documents in the world.
Wasn't it terribly dangerous for them to pursue that kind of activity, given the power or the waning or waxing powers of the Khmer Rouge in recent years?
Well, they're brave people. I think they deserve a lot of credit for their work, and they have contributed enormously to understanding what happened. Many of them, of course, were victims of the Khmer Rouge who lived through that particular regime.
The Cambodian Genocide Program also has a photographic database, and many, I think all of these photos are on your website. It's just horrific. Most of these photographs were from a Khmer Rouge practice of photographing victims before executing them. Why did these police document their victims?
I think they needed to have a record of what they had done, partly to show that they had carried out orders, but partly in order to achieve what they had done. It was on such a large scale that it could only have been attempted in a bureaucratic fashion. It was attempted very systematically, and people were recorded from the moment of their entry into the death camp by photograph, an entry sheet, a list of names of people arrested on that day, then monthly compendiums of the numbers of people and the names in the prison at a particular time for each month, and lists of people executed on particular days, all signed by the executioners and interrogators and torturers, with cover notes about the specific types of torture that had been administered, in a form of report to the chief of the prison, who was also chief of the security police, who then reported up the hierarchy to Sun Sen, the deputy prime minister in charge of security, who then copied Pol Pot or Nguyen Chia or other Khmer Rouge leaders, including the military commander, Mok, with particular documents that were of interest to their role in security and repression. So we have a chain of command which is established by a paper trail from the photographs of the victims right up to the copies that were sent of the covering letters reporting on their arrest and their confessions.
These photos came from a famous, infamous police detention center in Phnom Penh, Tuol Slang. How did you obtain the photos? Who found them?
The photos were found initially by one of the seven survivors of the 20,000 or so prisoners who went through that prison. This survivor became the director of the museum that was established to record and memorialize what happened. And as he was searching through the archives, he found his own photograph of the day he was arrested. He remembered the date, and he then set about establishing a photographic archive. And much later, a large number of negatives were found and printed out, and the Cambodian government made them available to us to display on the World Wide Web so that family members looking for missing relatives or victims of the Khmer Rouge could perhaps help identify these largely unidentified victims of the Khmer Rouge.
The prison is now a museum of genocide in Phnom Penh. Since the Khmer Rouge has had power in Cambodia off and on over the years, how has the museum explained its exhibits, or what are its exhibits?
Well, since 1979, when the Khmer Rouge were driven from Phnom Penh, it's been called the Tuol Slang Museum of Genocide, and it has been a display of torture, of techniques and instruments of torture, the cells where the prisoners were held, and the archives of the actual prison are also there, including reports from the interrogators to the prison chief about the nature of the torture and particular prisoners' responses to the torture and the confessions. In all, there are more than 100,000 pages of meticulous documentation of this particular crime.
You also obtained from the prison many of the written, so-called confessions that prisoners wrote under torture or threat of torture before execution.
There are some documents where people plead for their lives. There are others where people defiantly proclaim themselves, knowing that they are about to die. There are others where people proclaim themselves to be animals rather than human beings, abjectly begging for their lives. And the entire picture is a very sad one indeed.
You conducted, I think, over 500 interviews yourself to compile an oral history for the program and for your scholarship. How did you go about tracking people down and gaining their trust?
I began to interview refugees abroad who had fled the Khmer Rouge regime in Australia and particularly in France in 1979 after the overthrow of the regime. And I interviewed about 100 Cambodian refugees in the months following the overthrow of the regime. And then I was able to go to Cambodia in 1980 and continue my work interviewing people on the spot in their homes and workplaces, and interviewed approximately 400 more Cambodian survivors.
How willing, though, were people to talk to you? It was dangerous. And also, I would think that you were there in 1980, and that's a so recently traumatized by what the regime had done to the Cambodians.
There were a number of people who did not want to talk, but the number was quite small, surprisingly enough. But I think you can understand that the Cambodians felt that the international community should know about what happened to them, and they were very keen in large part to talk, and to talk on the record, in fact, Very few of them requested aliases, but I did choose not to reveal the names anyway, because the Khmer Rouge may wish to harm them.
You describe the Khmer Rouge's regime as the most brutal onslaught on the family in history, and you argue that the regime targeted the family in order to make ethnic cleansing and genocide easier in their program. What evidence do you have from these materials and the others that you've gathered about their theorizing about how best to accomplish these goals?
Well, the slogan that was used in the Khmer Rouge time was that the word family was used to describe a spouse. So the Cambodian word for family excluded the children in the Khmer Rouge period. And the children were considered by implication to belong to the government or to the state, the organization as the party was known, headed by Pol Pot. And the implementation of that ideology was that children were taken from their parents and brought up in barracks from which they rarely saw their parents. Perhaps once a week or once a month they would see their parents. Sometimes the parents, the spouses themselves, were separated and rarely saw each other. And of course, family eating was progressively outlawed in the Khmer Rouge period, so that by the last couple of years, people would eat their meals, even breakfasts, in sittings with the parents in one and the children in another. And this was something that had never happened in Cambodia before or any other country, to my knowledge.
And what was the purpose of that?
I think the purpose was partly to undermine the family and partly to make sure that food supplies and rations were strictly controlled. People could only eat what was served up to them in these communal mess halls, which meant that they could not store food under their houses. They were not allowed to pick fruit that was said to belong to the organization. They were not allowed to secretly cultivate private gardens for the family, vegetables and so on. And this prevented people from smuggling food to rebels who were opposing the Khmer Rouge regime. And that was a security purpose of this policy.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about what you have learned about how genocidal regimes work in general from studying all of the documentation that you have in the program.
Well, I think, firstly, it's been a surprise to most scholars, including myself, just how much documentation survived, and indeed how much existed in the first place. The records, or even the existence of the prison, Tuol Slang, was not known until after the Khmer Rouge were overthrown. It was such a secretive regime, a closed country, that the massive extermination center of Tuol Slang remained unknown to the outside world for the whole 4 years of the Khmer Rouge regime. And so the massive documentation there was a surprise. But if you consider the enormous scale of the killing and the rapidity and extremism of the projects that the Khmer Rouge embarked upon, leading to the death of nearly 2 million people in 4 years, it could only have been done by massive documentation and bureaucracy. I also think that we can learn something from the ideology of the Khmer Rouge, which was a mixture of Maoism and racism, and also, to some extent, Stalinism, an extremely explosive mixture developed by the Khmer Rouge, which propelled them to target entire groups of people for extermination or persecution on the basis of their race or their social class, and sometimes both, including all kinds of social groups, not just the city people and the elite, but peasants who died in approximately equal numbers to the urban dwellers who were evacuated from the cities.
My guest is Cambodian scholar Ben Kiernan. He directs the Cambodian Genocide Program at Yale University. We'll talk more after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ben Kiernan, director of the Cambodian Genocide Program at Yale University. Part of the genocide program involves training human rights organizers in Cambodia in international criminal law and human rights law. What's the purpose of the training?
Well, the training was provided in a couple of summer schools in 95 and 96 to enable Cambodians to participate in the search for justice for the victims of the genocide. And we familiarized them with international criminal law, for instance, the Genocide Convention, crimes against humanity, and war crimes, and various case studies. And then we familiarized them with the procedures of actually holding a tribunal or a truth commission, which would come to some accounting of what happened. So we were able to include Cambodian human rights workers as well as lawyers and prosecutors and police officials in Cambodia who may participate in a tribunal.
What is the likelihood, though, of a tribunal occurring to try these war criminals? Almost every major member of the Cambodian government had some involvement with the Khmer Rouge at some time.
My understanding is that Cambodians feel very strongly about justice as well as about reconciliation and peace. They don't see the trial of Pol Pot, which they wished would have happened, as conflicting with reconciliation or the future development of the country. They do, I think, insist that measures be taken to bring the remaining Khmer Rouge leaders to justice, especially the senior officials. And I think this is what resulted in the two Cambodian prime ministers last June appealing to the United Nations to establish an international tribunal. The UN has now set up a commission of experts to investigate the evidence of the genocide. And as well as that, the US President Bill Clinton has committed the State Department to the search for an international legal accounting for the crimes that were committed at that time. And I believe that the chances of apprehending one of the senior pillars of the Pol Pot regime, if not Pol Pot himself, who is now dead, but the head of state at that time, Khieu Samphorn, is still at large. The military commander, Mok, is still at large. And the deputy party leader under Pol Pot, Nguyen Chia, number two in the regime, is also still at large. And these people could be apprehended because their military forces are dwindling and they are restricted to a small area of Cambodia. And it's possible that in the future they or some of them could be captured.
What model do you think a war crimes tribunal should follow in bringing human rights abusers to justice in Cambodia?
Well, I think it needs to be international. The international community owes that to the Cambodian people. The ad hoc international criminal tribunals that have been established by the United Nations do provide a model for a Cambodian tribunal, although much of the evidence has been gathered already. And in a particular Cambodian case, not so much prior work need necessarily be required. And also, I think in the Cambodian view, they would like to see the tribunal in Cambodia itself, where the witnesses and the documents are located, and with Cambodian participation, which is slightly different to the Rwandan and Bosnian tribunals. I interviewed King Sihanouk about this 2 years ago, and he was very strongly of the view that there should be an international tribunal established by the UN, but that there should be Cambodian participation and that it should be located in Phnom Penh.
Do you think Pol Pot was murdered?
It's always going to be in doubt because of his expeditious cremation, which prevented an autopsy and determination of the cause of the death. But it's an open question.
I'm speaking with Ben Kiernan. He's a professor of history and the director of the Cambodian Genocide Program at Yale University. You were in Cambodia in 1975. Is that right?
Yes, in early 1975.
What were you doing there?
I was an undergraduate student, and I visited Cambodia just before the end of the war in February of 1975. From Australia.
Did you have any idea what was happening politically in the country, or soon to happen?
No, I was not able to predict that the Khmer Rouge regime would be as vicious and as systematically violent as it turned out to be.
Did you have friends who were victims of the Khmer Rouge?
Yes, all the people that I knew in Cambodia at the time of that visit died.
Were you trying to keep in contact with them during the time?
It was impossible to keep contact because the country was closed off as soon as the Khmer Rouge took over, and there was no postal contact and no other way of keeping in touch with people inside the country.
Are young Cambodians today clear on what happened 20 years ago?
I don't think the education system in Cambodia tackles this issue. There is still a good deal of research to be done before anyone will become clear about the total history of the Pol Pot regime. But the recently discovered documentation does make this possible in the long run and certainly provides evidence for a legal accounting.
Ben Kiernan directs the Cambodian Genocide Program at Yale University. Here's their website address, www.yale.edu/CGP. That's www.yale.edu/CGP. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.